Welcome to the After Talk at Universe University. I'm your host, Chris Grant. I just wanted to offer a reminder to all our listeners that my producer Blake and I take long hours away from our day jobs to bring you quality episodes with fascinating and well-qualified After Talk guests. If you haven't already, please consider contributing a small amount and following us on Patreon. On today's After Talk, I will be chatting with a good friend and an old professional mentor of mine. His name is Nick Conant. He's a professional science communicator and the theater manager of the Fisk Planetarium at the University of Colorado in Boulder, where I myself used to present shows on astronomy. Today, he'll be chatting with me about everything from the basics of astronomy to the politics and ethics of asteroid mining. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Yes, thank you, Chris. I enjoyed it a lot. It's great to be on your podcast because I enjoy just how thoroughly researched they are and the breadth of knowledge that you bring to these topics, things that I think the average astronomer isn't even aware of.
Well, I appreciate that. The podcasts do tend to be pretty long, but I like to think that I address subjects pretty comprehensively.
Well, absolutely.
First of all, could you explain what the late heavy bombardment is for our audience and listeners that may not know?
Yeah, so the principle of the late heavy bombardment period is that after the solar system had more or less formed, there was a period in time where a lot of objects that were still, I guess, not entirely confined to any one planet were cast around and started pretty much obliterating the surfaces of planets and impacting things all around the solar system. Some suggest that maybe it was caused by a migration of planets early in the solar system's period, where planets like Jupiter may have started closer to the sun and then migrated out to where its orbit is now, or Uranus and Neptune may have switched places, things like that, which may have disturbed a whole ring of asteroids or comets into different orbits, and then that triggered those over the course of the next few million years, impacting things like the sun, or impacting things like the Earth and objects closer to the sun.
So then the extensive cratering that we see on Mercury, Mars, the Moon, the Earth Moon, that would have taken place during the late heavy bombardment rather than more recently.
Yes, the idea is that there are some objects that have an enormous amount of cratering on them, and they haven't experienced cratering too much more recently. So if you see, say, the surface of Mercury is almost entirely covered in craters, that if you were to add any other craters to it, it would erase another crater in the process. And so an enormous number of these craters, especially the largest ones, may have originated with the period of the late heavy bombardment.
That's fascinating. So were there any thoughts? You mentioned you had a few notes regarding the episode.
Right. Well, one of the things that you started the episode out with Halley's Comet, and as it was seen in the Bayeux Tapestry in 1066, right? So this is probably the earliest and most famous recognition of a comet. Of course, we know that comets were recorded going back thousands of years, but this one certainly is the Europeans taking great note that some apparition of a comet appeared in the sky, and perhaps it was an omen of events to come. Strangely enough, it doesn't look like too many other things were recorded in that time period for something like Halley's Comet, right? If it was such a huge and bright object in the sky, why were there so few recordings of it, except for maybe that one and also the Chinese? But what about the people in the Americas? And this is one that I think very, very few astronomers are aware of. But the ancestral Puebloans of New Mexico may have actually recorded Halley's Comet as well at the same for that same crossing, the 1066 apparition of Halley's Comet.
That's fascinating. Now, didn't Fisk have a amazing program that ran a few times at the planetarium about Native Americans and astronomy?
Absolutely. Fisk actually has a long history of doing ethnic astronomy, where there is a wide variety of different cultures. There are a wide variety of different cultures around the world that have looked up at the sky and made notable measurements that are worth sharing with the people of your community. So anybody from anywhere around the world will find something new in listening to these stories. But one in particular that I've been working on with Dr. Erica Ellingson at the University of Colorado in Boulder is that of the people of Chaco Canyon in the American Southwest. And in Chaco Canyon is most famous for the supernova petroglyph, that is this appearance of a darkly tinted star next to a crescent moon, next to a hand shape. And people have wondered what this could be, but they most commonly think that it is a depiction of the supernova in 1054, that of the Crab supernova that we see today in beautiful Hubble Space Telescope images. So back in 1054, a star probably exploded and then was bright enough to be seen in the sky. And then the Chacoans thought this was such an amazing thing that they recorded it onto the canyon walls itself. Now, just beneath that, go ahead.
I was just going to say that that supernova and the remnants, the gas and dust left over from that supernova, is what we today call the Crab Nebula, right?
Right, and we don't actually have a name for the star. As far as I know, we don't really have a name for the star that preceded it.
So it would have been an extremely spectacular sight to behold in the sky.
It probably wasn't as spectacular as the Hubble Space Telescope images of it today, but nonetheless, it would have been a very bright object. You could see it in the sky for weeks after it happened. It's certainly notable for anybody who saw it. And the strange thing is we think the Chacoans recorded this, but we don't see any records from the Europeans for this, even though we know just 12 years later, they recorded Halley's Comet onto the Bayeux Tapestry. So what gives?
A mystery.
It is a mystery. And you'd say, well, if the Chacoans were sky observers, they had many depictions of stars, the sun, the moon. And you can find on this wall that holds the supernova petroglyph, lots of small stars pecked into it, not just sort of painted onto it or ensconced on it, but actually like kind of ground into it, probably with something like antlers or with other like stone tools. But you can see on this wall the supernova petroglyph, these little star indicators, and you can also see right beneath the petroglyph, completely overlooked, is what looks just like a comet. And that is very shocking. The pictures of this are almost impossible to get because I've been there myself a few times and tried to snap a picture with some very nice cameras, and it just doesn't work. When you look at it with your naked eye, it's obvious. It's two or three concentric rings, and then there is a flaming tail off to the right-hand side of those rings, and it's in this nice reddish hue that the same supernova petroglyph is in. And so this looks so much not like a campfire, right? The flames aren't going up. This doesn't look like, you know, a star, like a blast of light. This looks just like something you'd see depicting a comet.
What state is this in?
This is in New Mexico. And Chaco Canyon is only something like I think it's like a 14-mile long canyon. And you can go on something like a few mile walk through the desert or to this wall that is completely, you wouldn't even notice that this wall was special in any particular way until you go right up next to it and you see that, wow, there is a whole lot of astronomy things all over this wall. And I like to think of it as their astronomy wall, like their page in their encyclopedia. If the whole canyon is covered with their artwork, it's like their encyclopedia. And this wall tells us their astronomical history, where you can see what looks just like a pinkish reddish comet. And it's less protected than the supernova petroglyph is, because it's a little bit more exposed to the elements. The sunlight hits it, the water is more likely to hit it from any rain, the wind is more likely to blow it away. So that's why pictures just don't capture it very well. But it looks strikingly like Halley's Comet if you were to take a picture of it with an actual camera, like what it would really look like through a telescope.
That's really interesting. I wanted to use this opportunity while we have a moment. We actually got a listener asked a very basic question about astronomy recently to me, and I thought I would refer the question to you because as a science communicator and a science educator, that's part of your job, or at least has been part of your job at the Fisk Planetarium, is people asking basic questions about astronomy to kind of clarify some of the gaps in their understanding. Would you say so?
Absolutely.
So I'm pulling up the question right now. And so the question is, should we see different stars, or do we see different stars throughout different parts of the year, depending on what side of the sun we are on, because the Earth is orbiting the sun? So I think the question is relating to, as Earth orbits the sun throughout the year, and the motions of the stars and the planets throughout the year, because planets don't move the same as stars, and stars do move over the course. I say stars move. I guess it's our vantage point in outer space is changing, but for the sake of clarity, I talk about the motions of the stars and the planets. Is that question clear?
Yeah. So what's interesting is that as the Earth rotates, and you were to say, well, what's up in the sky tonight? If you were to wait for, say, 12 hours from sunset to sunrise, you would be able to see pretty much all the sky, all the stars in the sky, save for the ones that are directly behind the sun or in a patch right behind the sun. So when you look in any given direction out at sight at night, you'll be able to see over the course of the entire night, almost the entire sky's worth of stars, except for the, say, the zodiac constellation and the few that are right next to the sun in the sky. So the Earth's orbit around the sun takes it into, of course, different vantage points on those stars. So they appear at different times during the night, but the sunrise to sunset period only allows us to actually see so many of the stars in the night sky that only any given set of stars is only hidden from our view for only about 40 days of the year. You would just have to stay awake all night to actually see them.
So there are constellations and things that we can see in the northern hemisphere that we cannot see in the southern hemisphere, and vice versa, right?
Yeah. So I guess what I was saying is more applicable to if you live near the equator. So from the equator, you could see every single star in the night sky over the course of a year, because you have you don't have any angle. You're at exactly 0 degrees latitude on the Earth. So as the Earth turns, you're getting a perfect view of all the different stars in the night sky. Now, from 40 degrees north, you can't see the stars that are beneath, say, 50 degrees beneath the horizon. So there is only a limited set of stars you can actually see once you start going north or south on the Earth. And so the stars of the southern hemisphere of the sky are reserved for the equator in the southern hemisphere and, lower latitudes in the northern hemisphere. And the ones of the northern hemisphere, you can't really see as well from the southern hemisphere either.
Would you say that astronomers consider the equator to be particularly awesome place to do astronomy, or is there really no perfectly ideal site on Earth to conduct astronomy? Is it really just important that we have astronomical observatories all around the world?
You know, what's interesting is, just like you said, we probably would expect them to want to be right on the equator. Any astronomer, any telescope, why not just have it right on the equator so it can see the whole sky? The equator, though, is really well known for being full of a lot of storms, a great deal of moisture, and there's, of course, not too much land around the equatorial latitudes. So when astronomers get to place telescopes at where, you know, if they have a lot of money and they get to spend that money to place a telescope in only one place, where are they going to put it? They usually try to go for some place that's exceptionally dry, because moisture in the atmosphere causes stars to twinkle and can ruin what astronomers called seeing, and it's how well they can see anything in space. So they try to place telescopes in dry locations like deserts or the top of mountains. And they also try to place the telescopes in some place that would, say, give them a good access to space. So, of course, the higher up you go, the better. So the tops of mountains are not only dry, but they're also high up enough that they're above a great deal of the atmosphere. They get above all the turbulence of the atmosphere, above a lot of the weather as well. So places like Hawaii, very tall mountain of Mauna Kea, is an excellent place to bring astronomy to the world. The Atacama Desert in Chile, extremely high, extremely dry, is perhaps the driest place on the planet. So it's a great place to put telescopes.
There is an astronomical observatory just adjacent to the Fisk Planetarium, right?
That's right. That's the Summers Bausch Observatory.
So I gather that must have been built at some point decades ago when there wasn't as much light pollution in the city of Boulder.
Of course. Like many places in the United States, they have urbanized, and the telescopes that were there are almost useless now. So people know that, say, probably the most famous ones, like Griffith Observatory, say, in Los Angeles, is not really great anymore. People go there now for the planetarium. The Summers Bausch Observatory, or SBO, as we call it, is a great place to build an observatory in Boulder in the 1950s. So it was actually made in 1953, or constructed in 1953, and it was at the time considered to be so far away from the main CU campus that it was too far away. And so the administrator said, well, that observatory is almost useless because it's too far away from where the students can access it. And nowadays, it's completely surrounded by the CU campus. There are lights from the local lacrosse fields and the lights from the local residential areas that completely wash it out if we don't have those lights mitigated. But it also is a perfect location in the 1950s because that is situated on the highest hill in Boulder that is not part of the mountains. So believe it or not, that little hill that the Fisk Planetarium and the Summers Bausch Observatory is on, the little hill that they are on, is actually the highest hill in Boulder. That's not part of the mountains proper.
I did not know that.
A great place to build an observatory, right? You get above everybody else, above any of the lights if you can make it. And nonetheless, it's now been completely surrounded by the city of Boulder.
It's my understanding that the Fisk Planetarium didn't come about until later.
Yeah, Fisk was built in 1975, so it was about 22 years later. And the planetarium, of course, doesn't contribute much to the light pollution of our local observatory. There's even a number of trees around it, so that helps the astronomers at SBO do their work at night.
Is it true that Fisk is one of the highest resolution planetariums in North America?
Yeah. Well, it was when it was renovated in 2013. At the time, it was probably the highest resolution screen that, say, you could say a movie theater screen in the whole world, because it was an 8K resolution screen, not just like that YouTube 8K where it's actually something like 7340p or whatever it is. It's what we're talking about is actual 8,192 pixels by 8,000 pixels. So it would be the equivalent of YouTube 8K times two, and then you add some more to that. So it's about 33 Blu-ray players playing simultaneously in resolution.
Just to let our listeners know, I no longer work for the Fisk Planetarium, but I still think it's a magical place. And if you're ever in Colorado, certainly if you're ever in Boulder, definitely check it out.
Yeah, the Edmonton Planetarium in Canada is now actually a 10K resolution planetarium. And it's going to be hosting the International Planetarium Society Festival in later this year, in June of 2020 or July of 2020.
Will you be attending?
I hope to attend. One of the projects I'm working on has been accepted to be shown to the attendees of that festival. It's called the Voyagers Project, and it's going to be a play about the Voyager spacecrafts.
Like a stage play?
It is a stage play. There'll be two actors who'll be doing, they'll be playing six different roles. So between them, they each have three different roles that they'll be playing to embody what was happening to get Voyager launched once a Voyager was flying past each of the different planets, the different Voyagers, And so we're trying to follow along historically with those missions. And then they also play themselves, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, as if they were cast into the future by tens of thousands of years and had finally been intercepted by an alien civilization.
In what capacity did you work on this project?
Well, we're still trying to finish it up, and we hope to premiere it in March of 2020, so just a few months from now. We're more or less calling this one the Voyagers 1 project, because we hope that we'll be able to make it even better in the future, perhaps in time for the IPS, and we'll call that Voyagers 2.
Were you a technical consultant, writer, director?
I didn't really have any input in writing the script. I did do a little bit of scientific advising in that capacity, but the majority of my work on this project has been to design some of the visuals to go along with it. So the script, as was handed to me, has a lot of very creative ideas of how to imagine what Voyager actually was doing, what it would be like to actually be riding along with the Voyager spacecrafts as they were going past Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, but as well as what was happening in the minds of the astronomers who were imagining what it would be like for themselves. So I've helped to develop the visuals for the Voyager project in a flight of fancy way, in what the most imaginative astronomers like Carl Sagan would be thinking of, and also in the realistic way. And so if you get to see the program, the Voyagers program, then hopefully you'll be able to see what was actually happening in both in the minds of the astronomers, who some of which are still alive, and the actual Voyager spacecraft as they flew by.
It sounds like an incredible show.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, because I love live plays. I love that Fisk does do live plays. Not all planetariums have a stage. Not all planetariums humor the idea of teaching astronomy or trying to engage an audience through anything besides movies or Star Talks. But with us doing this play to try to bring the history of the Voyager spacecrafts to our Boulder community is very exciting.
That's what I think is truly unique about the Fisk Planetarium, is that some planetariums are more or less domed movie theater screens, whereas the Fisk Planetarium is something just altogether a unique experience.
Yeah, the majority of planetariums don't have the funding or the staff to be able to do anything besides play those movies. And they'll occasionally be able to use their star projectors to show you what's in the sky that night. Fisk holds the mantle of being experimental. If you look out at different planetarium websites, you'll find that we're known for pushing the limits of what can be done in a planetarium. And so that keeps it really exciting to be working there.
So before we pivot back to chatting about the episode and comets and asteroids, I did want to mention on a side note, you were actually contacted by the filmmakers who made First Man.
That's right.
What were they asking you about?
Believe it or not, they said, well, you're the 10th astronomer we've talked to, but we just need to know how to pronounce the name of some stars that our lead actor who is going to be playing Neil Armstrong is going to try to be pronouncing the names of these stars in reference to how to navigate by the stars when he's on his trip to the moon. And I went, oh, okay, well, that sounds very interesting. And they said, yeah, he's going to be played by Ryan Gosling. And I went, oh, okay, I'll have to think about, you know, what do I know about how he pronounces stars? I'll have to think about what context is he going to be trying to say these stars in? Because you might imagine that the way you pronounce a star would change based off of even where Neil Armstrong was from. How would he try to pronounce the name of a star? So some people, like in Boston, they can chew their T's. Instead of saying a star like Arcturus, they can say Arcturus. And so the T becomes a ch, so it becomes Arcturus instead of Arcturus. And so when you put that in the context of how different people would even be playing, different actors would play different people to say different star names, it becomes very convoluted. But they said, well, I want to know what the name of the star is for, I think it was Sigma Sagittarii. And I went, oh, I've never heard of that one before. He said, I think it's like Nunki, Nunki, Nunkai. I have no idea. I have actually never heard of the name of this star. And I know many astronomers who've given star talks who know many more stars than me, and they can be even sticklers about pronunciation. And he went, well, you've got all the other ones down, like Betelgeuse seems like a pretty solid pronunciation of that star instead of Betelgeuse. Very few people say Betelgeuse, so we're going to just have them say Betelgeuse. Went, okay. And he went, but Noonkey, we can't seem to find anybody who knows how to pronounce the name of that star.
I just thought that was a fascinating story and kind of an interesting claim to fame. I just wanted to get you to retell it.
Yeah, well, you know, I told him at the end of it, the people who know more about stars than me, why don't I give you their numbers and you can actually call those people? And he went, no, I think we're done. I've gone through so many astronomers and the last one led to you. So I feel like the consensus is we're just going to go with Noonkey. And I have yet to see First Man, believe it or not. It's on my to-do list watching.
I think I recall after you told me about that, I saw the movie First Man, listening with bated breath for someone to say the word Noonkey, and no one ever did.
Yeah, I get the impression that it actually never made the cut. But I have been chewing through all the movies on my bucket list, and now that's in my top two or three, so I'll hopefully get to hear it for myself if he even says the word Betelgeuse, and I'll say, hey, I helped a little bit.
Maybe we can have a podcast where we just talk about the most scientifically and astronomically accurate movies that there are out there.
I feel like that would be a whole lifestyle at that point. There's actually a page that NASA has for science fiction writers on how to properly convey science, or how to make sure that their science is accurate in their science fiction.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so if you ever want to become go into the world of science fiction writing and you don't know too much about astronomy, NASA's got you covered.
Have you seen the film Deep Impact?
That one's from the 90s, right?
Correct.
No, I haven't seen it, but I did watch Armageddon, and I get the impression that they have shared a lot of similarities.
They do share a lot of similarities. Deep Impact gets credit for being much more scientifically accurate, in my opinion. And so I would recommend that film to you as well as all of our listeners if you want to see a big budget science fiction film that is very scientifically accurate.
Well, you know, there's this great one called what's it called? Star Wars. Oh, that one is wonderful too. No, I don't think there's almost anything in Star Wars that's scientifically accurate.
I actually have heard some people say it's best to describe Star Wars as science fantasy or just fantasy.
Yeah, I've even heard that applied to Star Trek, where people say, oh, the faster than light travel in Star Trek makes it, therefore, a fantasy. Everything else that it tries to describe in there science fiction-wise now pegs it into being a fantasy. Even though they have even tried to explain that they are not going faster than the speed of light, they are actually traveling through space. They're allowing space to warp around their spaceship, allowing them to sort of go faster than light in that sense. But they're not actually moving their spaceship at faster than light.
Knowing what you do about astrophysics, do you think it's sort of a pipe dream to think that any time within the next, say, 100 to 200 years that we'll see anything, you know, anything approaching the ability to travel close to the speed of light, let alone to go faster than that or to warp space faster than that? There are popular headlines that I think are a little misleading saying, you know, NASA is working on warp drive, like in the series Star Trek.
Well, I have a lot of, I would say, controversial opinions on that. I think that when you give humans a challenge and you say that something can't be done, then they will find a way to do it, even if it can't be done in any traditional sense. So even if we can't go faster than the speed of light in any traditional sense, I think that the way that Star Trek overcomes that barrier is very similar to how we will probably overcome that barrier in the future. And so I'm extremely optimistic that we will find some way to go faster than the speed of light, or we will not even think of it as a barrier. That perhaps we will just find out how to teleport better than we have to try to figure out then how to go faster than light. And we might find some secret passage through something like quantum entanglement that, even though right now it looks like it might violate causality in certain ways, In other words, that you can't make things happen before they've actually happened, that you can't communicate information at anything faster than the speed of light. I think that there may be secrets to behold in the quantum universe, in quantum physics, or even in future branches of physics that we don't even know exist yet, that will help us transcend that limitation that we call the speed of light. Now, to the other half of your question, right? Do we think that we'll ever be able to approach the speed of light in the next few hundred years? I think we can. You've done an excellent way of describing the Project Orion, in previous podcasts, which is that it was a theoretical spacecraft that, using nuclear power, could actually go up to something like a fifth the speed of light. And so I think that we can get our world together and muster within ourselves to use nuclear weapons or nuclear power at all in space to travel to worlds previously out of reach.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I think you're a little bit more optimistic than me, perhaps, but no one would be more delighted than I if that future that you describe comes to pass.
Do you think that humans will remain slower than the speed of light for perhaps all time?
I'm kind of sad to say that perhaps that might be the case. I think in general, space travel, and in particular manned space travel with human beings in the picture, is something that political leaders, nations, don't care that much about and haven't been really willing to make serious investments in since the 1960s.
Yeah, well, they... I guess that politically, there's only so much that space travel can do for you, because you have your treasury that you have to allocate well enough that you're not going to be overthrown or you're not going to be kicked out of office. You know, you want to make everybody happy.
It's expensive.
In fact, yes, human space travel is extremely expensive. You know, it was difficult for Christopher Columbus to even get funded to go across the ocean blue to try to find new lands, or to even find a passageway to India, is what he was hoping to go for, right? It's how to make it all the way across to Asia from Europe. But he had to solicit funding many, many times before eventually he got funded, and it led to such a great discovery. So it's funny how history repeats itself in a way that this human travel always reveals things that we never would have expected, and yet nobody wants to pay for it.
Yeah, I appreciate the historical parallel. I suppose if I had to boil down our two opinions, the scientist and the astronomer in you looks at the world and says, anything is possible if we set our minds to it. And the pessimistic political scientist in me says, gosh, I don't know if the politics are ever going to come together in such a way where our leadership will spend the money to make that a reality.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the big revelation for me is that if you wait long enough and the technology can advance long enough and your population can grow enough and maybe your society gets fed up enough with war, you kind of find that your fish tank is becoming too crowded and people want to go out and find new land, right? So much of founding new cities, discovering new lands, is driven by like a search for wealth or a search for meaning or purpose, or to think that, you know, you could be part of something greater than all the ancestors previous to yourself have been part of. And so I think it's only a matter of time that our civilization can survive on Earth before we actually think about, before we're actually kind of forced to go off and say, there's something greater out there than just life here on Earth. We need to go there. And they'll be seen as extremists and radicals for saying, wow, you actually want to go to some place that's so unsafe. The threat of even leaving, you know, like going across the ocean is a threat of dying, right? Going across the vastness of space, the ocean of space, is a huge threat of dying. Right now, the odds of dying just from a rocket launch into space is like 1% to 2%. And yet Elon Musk wants to send people to Mars before he dies. And people are saying, this is a very, very ambitious goal. And he's saying, but the future of humanity isn't staying on Earth forever. There's only two options, as Carl Sagan described it, is that we either stay on Earth forever or we go into space. And that is it.
Yeah, Carl Sagan said, if we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an inspirational message, to be sure. Was there anything in the episode that stood out to you regarding comets and asteroids?
Let me look through my notes. Let's see. Perhaps one of the most interesting ones for me was that when comets and asteroids come to impact planets like the Earth or, you know, Mars, Venus, the Moon, any hard terrestrial body, we tend to look at how big is the crater. We're trying to look for craters on the Earth as a sign of things that have hit it in the past. And we think, wow, like the bigger the crater, the more impressive it is. And yet when they streak through the sky, even as just tiny little shooting stars, they're very small, they're very bright, and we're still in awe at just how small it can be. So no matter what size it is as it enters the atmosphere, it's always amazing. And the ones that are very, very small, just the shooting stars, we love those. And the huge ones like the Chelyabinsk asteroid that comes in and, you know, blows out the windows in obscure Russian towns, those ones we say, oh, well, we don't like it when those come in, those come through, but they're scary impressive.
Yeah, the Chelyabinsk in particular, watching some of those videos is striking, that you're looking at something that seems to be glowing brighter than the sun.
Yeah, the pressure as those things come in through the atmosphere, right? They're going something like 70 kilometers a second. And it depends on whether they're trying to catch up to the Earth or if the Earth is running into them. Because if they're trying to catch up to the Earth, they're only going something like 10 miles a second. But if the Earth is running into them, then they can be going, you know, you're adding then the Earth's momentum to their speed. And they're going to go so fast that as they're impacting the atmosphere, they will glow extremely bright. And if they're a big enough size, they will explode before they even reach the ground. So you won't even have the, you know, the luxury of saying, I'm going to go over and pick up that rock once it's done. The thing like with Tunguska is it just will explode. And you'll be left with a huge mess to clean up and very little remnants of, say, the bullet that was shot.
That's a fascinating topic. And I was actually speaking to some elementary school students regarding asteroid impacts. And it's curious that one of them asked me, okay, that's the crater. Where's the meteor? Where's the asteroid? And in fact, the Barringer meteor crater, sometimes just referred to as Meteor Crater in, I believe it's Arizona, one of the best preserved meteor craters in the world. Have you ever been there?
Yeah, I have been there. And I was surprised to find that you have to pay to get in to this thing that is, say, a mile wide. And you can look at just how deep this thing is. It's so freshly preserved. And I think it's only like 55,000 years old. It's not too old, if I recall.
That's true. Yeah, it came down when human beings were on this earth.
Yeah, and the meteor crater is I think there are three primary fragments left over from it, one of which actually sits in the Fisk Planetarium lobby.
That's awesome. All I was going to say is that there's an interesting story that we didn't get to tell in the episode, that this guy, Barringer, essentially, I think, died poor, lonely, and broke because he spent such an enormous amount of time looking for meteorite fragments, and he was actually sort of mocked by the scientific community, who thought it was that the crater was from a volcanic caldera. And they said, oh, you fool, you actually think that some giant space rock came out of the sky and made this hole? You're never going to find anything. And he found very little. And even though he was convinced, he said, well, I know in my heart that this was an impact from a cosmic impact. And I'm so certain of that. And I'm going to make my fortune once I find all the fragments of this. And so he was right about the fact that it was, in fact, a cosmic impact and not a volcanism that created the crater. But he was mistaken about the fact that he would find this enormous wealth of metal from the object that hit.
Yeah, it's I guess supremely ironic that it's a giant hole that is facing up toward the sky, right? It's a huge crater facing up to the sky, and we have the audacity to say, oh, that had to come from the ground. It's not like you dropped something on a cosmic scale onto the Earth, and then it splashed out and made this crater. And of course, volcanic calderas and craters do look surprisingly similar. But to so quickly dismiss the idea that this thing could have come from the sky when it even looks like it's pointing directly back up to the sky is funny to me.
Well, even the enormous Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan Peninsula from the object that killed the dinosaurs, that was misidentified as a volcano as well. And only many, many, many years later did they conclude it's actually from an asteroid impact as well.
Yeah, that one, if that were the case, that would be like a super volcano, because that was a very large impact crater. And it even had so many different concentric rings around it that you'd say, you know, surprisingly circular. It seems odd that you could attribute that to something like a volcano, right? Volcanoes can be a little bit more organic and natural in the way that they form their calderas, it seems. But when you see something that is so circular, like Meteor Crater, it makes you think, that is a little bit surprising. I think some people have even suggested that, say, Hudson Bay has a big circular outer ring to it on the eastern side. That may be a source of an impact crater. And I know that's very contentious. There's not very much consensus there, but...
So with Meteor Crater or the Barringer Crater in Arizona, was that a case of an object that exploded or largely vaporized, and that was why good old Mr. Barringer didn't find a whole lot of large fragments?
I'm not sure about what formed the Meteor Crater one, but the thought is that if this thing is, say, a mile wide, then the impactor that made it was probably only a tenth of a mile wide. We normally can relate the impact crater size as being about 10 times larger than the thing that made it, or maybe 20 times larger than the thing that made it. And the other rule of thumb is that something that's about, say, 10 meters wide will almost certainly explode when it goes into Earth's atmosphere. So it's very difficult for you to find anything that is larger than 10 meters that won't explode as it goes into the Earth's atmosphere. And likewise, anything that's smaller than, say, a meter or maybe a tenth of a meter will burn up before it even hits the ground. So you have this very small range of things that are about a meter in size to 10 meters in size, which is, say, something like 3 feet to about 33 feet wide, that can actually survive a trip to the ground for you to recover any pieces. And so if you were to say, well, I'm going to multiply something 33 feet wide by 10, then you would say it only makes something that's about 330 feet wide. We know that this Barringer crater is much larger than that. So the thing that impacted almost certainly exploded somewhat before it hit the ground. And then the ram pressure helped to create the crater. That'd be my guess.
That sounds like a pretty good guess. I was going to ask you, are you familiar with these Electric Universe people?
Electric Universe? No, I'm not.
It's a very fringe group of people. If you type in Electric Universe in YouTube, you can get a wealth of different videos. And it provides a very, I would say, very bold and contentious challenge to a lot of popularly held ideas in astronomy. And one of their many fringe, kind of strange beliefs is that craters on the moon and other planets were created by electrical discharge rather than asteroid impacts.
Yeah, this is actually ringing a bell for me. That seems like a very difficult thing to make in outer space, given how common asteroids and comets are. They would be most likely the progenitors of those craters, as where over such large scales like space, electricity seems to, there seems to be no charge. It tends to be a very neutral amount of electricity in space, that you don't find that the sun is positively or negatively charged, or any planet has any, you know, positive or negative charge to it. Such large objects almost always have a neutral charge because they've just collected so much matter. So to suggest that some sort of electrical discharge on pretty much every single planet has created all of these craters when there are just rocks even floating around in space seems like a very strange hypothesis.
I was deeply skeptical of it myself, but I couldn't help but bring it up because people do ask me about astronomy. And while I do consider myself a science educator to some extent, I am first and foremost a sort of amateur historian. in regards to science and space flight and space exploration. So it is important, I think, to always defer to the scientists when talking about science and addressing misconceptions and such.
My thought is the same. As I don't always think of myself as being the most competent on these sort of issues, and sometimes I end up asking the more qualified professors at the University of Colorado who actually have spent their life studying these sorts of things. Now, it can be the case that you can get an astronomer, you can stump an astronomer pretty easily if you go outside of their field of research, because some study black holes, and they love nothing more than to study the depths of black holes, and they can't tell you very much about the new research done on Mars, and the reciprocal is true. So sometimes the amateur astronomers can one-up professional astronomers in their knowledge, and I try to take the aggregate knowledge of all the professors at the university and try to learn everything they have to tell me to try to make it so when I answer questions for people at the planetarium, I can tell them what the opinions of these different professors are.
That's fascinating. Well, is there anything else that was standing out in the episode? I suppose I'm letting you drive the conversation too much when I could have a list of questions to ask you. Pick your brain.
Right. Well, so there's one thing, which is the Apophis, right? This is the asteroid that is going to make a close approach to the Earth, skimming its outer atmosphere in something like 2029, is it?
Correct.
See, back in when it was discovered, I think, in the early 2000s, is it? I'm not too sure, but it was discovered long ago.
I think that's correct.
I remember there was in the local newspaper, like my small city's newspaper had an article about this Apophis, and they said, oh, it's going to, it has like a 1 in 36 chance of hitting the Earth in 2029. And if it then when it comes back around for a second approach, because Earth's gravity will pull it back in, there's about a 1 in 10,000 chance of it hitting the Earth at that point in 2036. And I said, wow, that is scary. I hope we've developed something by that time that will make this not the case. And as I've kept my ear to the ground on this issue over the last few decades, is that the numbers have been refined and refined and refined until now it's like a 1 in a million chance of it ever hitting the Earth.
So we really don't have anything to worry about.
I certainly hope not. It would be interesting if there was an evil Elon Musk that tried to pull the thing into an impacting orbit with the Earth. But we just have to hope that it's, you know, nobody tries to mess with it. Nobody decides, I'm going to blow a chunk off and put it into a stable orbit around the Earth in order to mine the thing or to do some scientific research. And then you have the start of a movie plot there where everything goes wrong and you have debris falling from the sky. So I'm not sure what the future will hold, because 2029 is far enough away that I can imagine something, somebody being ambitious about what to do with such an amazingly large and interesting asteroid coming by the Earth.
You make a good point regarding asteroid mining, that one of the challenges, one of the many challenges, I should say, that exists there is even these near-Earth objects, as we call them, are very far out in space, and we haven't, certainly human beings personally, haven't explored beyond low Earth orbit. So just getting an asteroid would be very difficult, and it might be more prudent to find something that was coming close to us rather than going out to it.
Yeah, I guess you have the thought is if you were to go out to the thing that's far, far away from you, you can do almost anything you want and nobody's going to try to fight you. Because if you were, say, all the way out in the asteroid belt, or you're just going out to 10 million miles from the Earth, whatever you do is yours. But if you can see something like Apophis, even from the Earth, or you could say that, wow, there is an asteroid closer to us than has ever been in my lifetime, I'm going to go out there and try to explore it, or I'm going to try to mine it. All of a sudden, you will think, well, this is stuff that's almost like it's happening on Earth. And then the politics will start to rile up, right? People will say, well, what sort of claim does this ambitious asteroid miner have on this asteroid? And if they were to pose a threat to all of humanity by doing asteroid mining so close to the Earth, don't they owe some of that wealth to us in return for risking all of our lives on such an ambitious endeavor?
I confess that's a point I never really thought about. Did you know that during the early days of the space race, there were discussions about airspace? And obviously the airspace over the United States is owned by the United States, and the airspace over the Soviet Union is owned by the Soviet Union. But they were thinking, even before Sputnik, about how far up does that airspace really extend? And if people start building spy satellites, do you then get into a situation where you're crossing into someone's airspace illegally under international law, even though you're just kind of orbiting the Earth? And so essentially legal scholars were sort of debating this question, at which point the Soviet Union shocked the world and launched Sputnik, and it was orbiting the Earth. It had orbited the Earth a couple of times undetected before it was formally announced. And Eisenhower's immediate response, in private at least, was, "Oh, good, now we don't have to worry about that anymore." That answers the question. You know, if the Soviets are doing it, then we can do it, and the Soviets won't bitch and moan and criticize us for it.
It's interesting that, I guess, being pioneers of that, they got to set the precedent.
Absolutely. I never knew that. And I would imagine with asteroid mining and other topics that are quandaries and paradoxes for space law, as you might call it, will probably be solved by established precedents that are established in the future.
Right. Well, if I may be so bold, I think this is where it's important to remember that NASA, you know, set people on the moon, and a lot of intellectuals have gone out of their way to say that NASA should be the one to set the precedent instead of letting these private companies that are going out there anticipating the greed as their primary motivator as setting the precedent. Because if you were to say that, well, if NASA can go and mine an asteroid first and say, well, we're not going to do A, B, and C because we think that would be too much of a risk, or they can determine what actually is too risky. They can determine, well, the whole world is looking at us and they're looking at how we're setting our standards. We are now becoming the standard bearers for perhaps the whole future of humanity in what is okay for mining asteroids. And so if they start to very ambitiously start to mine asteroids, then like Deep Space Industries or any other companies that come up that want to start mining will say, well, what is the precedent? And I think that these companies have been founded, right? But isn't Deep Space Industries owned or funded by James Cameron?
I think you're correct. Yeah, he was one of the donors.
Right. So to have him be, the donors, say, to be the moral code bearer for all of humanity on the subject is a very precarious situation to be in. Right. It's kind of like saying, well, Christopher Columbus is going to cross the ocean. Here we go again with this analogy. If Christopher Columbus crosses the ocean and decides that he's going to use an eclipse to try to convince the local natives to give him food and water and things to make it so he can get back to his homeland, then that kind of sets a precedent. And we now recall that Columbus wasn't actually a wonderful person, whether you look at it in his own time period or you look at it back from our current time period. He was always kind of looking out for himself and not really a great moral teacher. So if you're saying, well, the most moral we can do for asteroid mining is going to be James Cameron, then I want off this rock, right?
Yeah, I think you make an interesting point, because we live in an administrative state, and part of living in an administrative state means that administrative agencies in the United States government have judicial and legislative powers, even though they are not judges or legislators.
Yeah, I think that this is a very interesting place that humanity is finding itself, where all too quickly, especially, you know, situated here early 2020, private corporations have more money, more wealth, and more power than they have had in maybe 100 years. And they're so poised to try to use that to become even more powerful, even more wealthy, that if they wanted to go try to aggressively mine asteroids for their own purposes, you could even imagine something like the U.S. military saying, well, actually, these asteroids in the wrong hands could be used as kinetic missiles. that if you were to drop it on your enemies, it could make it even look like, oh, it was just an asteroid that skipped under the radar. It doesn't even have the signature of being an actual weapon. It's just a space rock from outer space. Who's to say whether it came naturally, if it was launched by somebody else? And while that's like a very, it's a very crazy idea to think about, you have to imagine that someday in the future, if we're trying to asteroid mine around the surface of the Earth, we're going to have to protect ourselves from what's happening in space. Just outside the atmosphere, if we're precariously hanging all these asteroids, the more and more we launch things up into space in the future, we're going to have to be very careful about what our policy is like to get things up and down and even into orbit, because currently only the wealthiest and the most well-managed governments are trying to actually launch satellites into space and trying to be careful about how they deorbit those satellites, or if they try to even obliterate other countries' satellites, as we're sometimes known to do.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I confess that the movie Deep Impact, which I recommended to our listeners earlier, I watched it recently, and it gave me actually a strange feeling of existential dread for a number of reasons, largely that the threat of cosmic impacts is very real and that they have happened throughout Earth's history, but also that the President of the United States goes on TV to address the nation and explain that there's a comet on a collision course with Earth. And I just cringed to myself because I thought, oh no, if this were reality, it would fall to the current administration. It would fall to Donald Trump to essentially play science educator on a subject that he and indeed the vast majority of political leaders in our country know very little to nothing about.
Right, and I can hardly bear to make this joke, but when he goes and says, oh, this is a meteoric, meteorically bad news, it's fake news, I don't believe that this thing is real. It's just the fancy scientist trying to scare me away and saying I'm not qualified to be president.
Right.
It's like this is, when he goes up and looks at solar eclipses without wearing eclipse glasses, you just think that this guy really, he also likes the idea of a space force. When, of course, they just recently published what the Space Force costumes would look like, not costumes, uniforms, and they all are camouflage.
Right.
It's like, this is hilarious. Donald Trump is, you also famously asked, I think it was during the first 500 days of his presidency, he asked some of the top NASA, I think it was his transition team for the NASA administration, he asked them, can we get people to Mars? And they said, well, not in 4 years. And he said, well, I want somebody on Mars by the end of my first term. And they said, we can't do that. He said, well, imagine if your budget was huge. And they went, we still can't do it. He said, no, I mean like bigger than you can even think about. If you had the biggest budget you can even imagine. They said, we can't do that. You can't get a person on Mars in 4 years. And this was already some time into his administration anyway. So it'd be like 3.5 years. The sort of understanding he has about how difficult it was to get somebody to the moon, not to mention to get somebody out 9 months away to land on the red planet Mars, when he even has, if he likes to fancy himself a billionaire, another billionaire like Elon Musk can't even do that. And that's been essentially his whole 10-year goal with SpaceX. He doesn't quite understand the gravity of space and how difficult it is to do anything involving space.
Yeah, and while everything you said is completely true, I have to point out that it's not just Donald Trump that John F. Kennedy, considered one of the greatest space presidents by many, and perhaps rightfully so, was having conversations with NASA Administrator Jim Webb, where he said, well, to be honest, I'm not really that interested in space. This is all just politics. And that John F. Kennedy actually began to feel really crestfallen when he realized that human beings would not be landing on the moon under his presidency, even if he were to get another term in office.
Interesting. Wait, so you're saying that he was very crestfallen, that it didn't happen during his time? It wouldn't happen during his office?
Yeah, he was very depressed about that because I think John F. Kennedy envisioned by 1967 or 1968, sometime in his second term, he would get to take the credit for that rather than, you know, someone coming after, some other administration coming after him.
And I see.
And there are these private conversations where James Webb is telling him, we might be able to orbit the moon by the very end of 1968 or the beginning of 1969. And that shows you just how amazing and prophetic James Webb was in his prediction, because it was December of 1968 when we first orbited the moon. And it wasn't until the summer of 1969 that we made our first attempt to land.
I find that hilarious that he was crestfallen it wouldn't even happen during his term in office, not that that he wouldn't get to say the speech, say, you know, to take credit in the sake of, wow, we did the most grandiose human achievement ever. But he was looking at only the political side of it, or probably looking at the majority of it, just the political side of how good this would make him look for the sake of getting people to land on the moon.
Absolutely. And he played the same game with NASA Administrator James Webb, where he said, well, what if we change NASA's budget to this? What if we raise NASA's budget to that? And James Webb had to kind of explain to him, almost in a condescending way, look, it's not just a matter of money. It's going to take time to develop this sort of space infrastructure to make this a reality. So there's not a magic number that you're going to give me where it's going to change the timetable.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, it is a matter of time at a certain point. Because you could say, you know, you just want to bake this cake in 1 minute, but you're saying, well, it's going to come out burnt. It's going to be goopy in the middle. This isn't how this works. You literally have to use time as a resource. And I figured that such a great politician like JFK would have even been able to anticipate that himself, to look at it from a broader scheme and say, what is his place in history? What is the U.S.'s place in history with undertaking this achievement? Not just for the sake of how is it going to benefit him in a second term, a hypothetical, you know, future where now he can benefit from such a great achievement. It's not like he would be able to do very much with that after the fact. It's not like he's trying to get reelected for a third term. He'd sort of been looking at this so much larger picture for saying, we need to make it so that for the good of the world, we can posture ourselves in such a way that we can benefit from the vast scientific knowledge and resources that we poured into this, not just for political games, but for the gains of the whole world for the next 50 years.
Yeah, it kind of demystifies Camelot and John F. Kennedy. But the other thing that I would say is there are a lot of presidents throughout American history who were especially knowledgeable about, for instance, foreign policy or how to conduct a war or the American economy or the monetary system. But there really, aside from perhaps Lyndon Johnson, there really aren't any leaders that stand out as being astoundingly well-versed in space or even hard science as a whole.
Well, I bet if you asked Donald Trump, he would say that he knows everything about space and there's nobody knows more about space than him. You know, I've thought often if an astronomer could actually be elected president. And in fact, I think there's only one physicist who's actually in Congress right now. I think it's like Pultz or Polk or something from, but no, it's Holt. I think it's Holt of like New Jersey. He runs like a quantum physics lab or something. And he's finally made it to be a congressman. But I think that they just lack the charisma, that astronomers would find everything in politics so utterly boring that they just couldn't bear a normal day of politics in the Oval Office, not to mention, you know, they would have their head lost in the clouds of, wow, think about how much we could be doing worldwide or for the future of humanity for the next 1,000 years if we just did everything correct in this 4-year period.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Much to my chagrin, as a person who studied political science, there has only been one president in American history who was a political scientist.
Really? Who is that?
Woodrow Wilson.
Go figure. He was always had a penchant for the scientific anyway. A little bit of an ego to go along with it too, though.
Certainly, certainly. One of the other points I was going to make that while watching Deep Impact gave me a little bit of existential dread was the reality that as human beings, we're increasingly reliant on technology. And so much of the technology that runs our day-to-day lives works fairly well that we almost have a tendency, I think, to deify technology and to believe it can solve all of our problems. And if you look at space technology, is still very, very new, very difficult, very expensive, and very dangerous. The first three-man space capsule that the United States tried to build to send man to the moon malfunctioned and burned three of its astronauts inside of it. The first Soviet space probes that attempted to land on Mars, some of them, Soviets lost contact with them. One of them crashed on the surface. One of them landed on the surface and they lost contact with it. So the first time that we try to do something in space that we've never done before, it often doesn't work out according to plan. And whether it's the film Deep Impact or the film Armageddon, I just can't help but almost get goosebumps just thinking about us being in a situation where we had to deflect or destroy an asteroid and coming up with a plan, but trusting that that plan to do something that we've never done before in the history of space travel was going to work.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. The first of which being, you know, right, our reliance on technology seems to be greater than it ever has. And strangely, it's facts like it's like this, where the human race produces twice as much fertilizer than the entire planet does every year. And so to feed all 8 billion people on the planet, and they are all, you know, even if they're barely being fed, we need to make twice as much fertilizer as the whole planet. If we lost the plants and the manufacturing that goes into producing that much fertilizer, we would lose so much of our civilization within the first few years, as we saw massive food shortages. So even if you said, well, I can live without a cell phone, or we can learn to live without, you know, our computers, because we can go back to paper money, we can keep using the mailing system, we can say, well, even if we somehow lost our ability to use fossil fuels and we didn't use cars or anything like that, how are you going to feed everyone? It's going to be extremely difficult to find a way to feed everybody. And even if you got past that, then you would say, well, that was pretty much our reliance on technology was forefront right there, the ability to feed everyone.
I think the disturbing irony there is, even though it's obviously vitally important that everyone on the Earth has food, fertilizer itself has so many harmful effects on the environment and might very well be the reason so many bees are dying off.
Right, yeah, poisons from different chemicals contributing to our, to the rivers, the oceans. You can see these explosive growths of algae that are killing off so many species. There's a lot that can be done from all this fertilizer, but we're even furthering our dedication to this game of saying we're even more reliant on technology in the next 10 years than we were even the previous 10 years. We're not somehow making ourselves less reliant. We're only becoming more reliant.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. So,
yeah, and what you mentioned about how much, say, if something like a Deep Impact scenario were to happen, what is our technology going to look like? If you were to say, well, even if we had imagine a coronal mass ejection obliterating the satellite communications on Earth, or the GPS satellites and all the satellites we have. There's something like 5,000 satellites in orbit that are currently functioning. It would drastically reduce our ability to wage war, which would be phenomenal. Probably that would reduce the ability of the loss of life in the case of a loss of technology. But it would lead to an enormous amount of chaos, and humanity would learn a very difficult lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. And this might be sort of a dark thing to say, but I almost wonder if we need some sort of event like that to get us to reevaluate our reliance on technology. It might be a lesson that we have to someday learn the hard way.
Yeah, kind of like, right, we have to lose the ozone layer before we eventually take actions. And now the ozone layer has thankfully almost completely healed itself. I'm glad we can say that in the year 2020. and we're looking at global warming as the next existential crisis. So it's something that we're doing to ourselves. In both cases, it was something that we're doing to ourselves. It was slow and persistent, as where something like an asteroid or meteoroid coming to hit us would happen in an instant. We almost certainly wouldn't know about it until it was too late in order to do something about it. And we almost wouldn't have any anticipation of a coronal mass ejection, right? If the sun were to billow off a huge amount of material to eradicate the satellites in space, we would only have like 2.5 days worth of information, maybe even a day and a half before that solar wind came and just destroyed pretty much all of our futuristic technology in space and disrupted the communications on Earth as well. So, you know, it overload power grids, and we would just have such mass chaos that people wouldn't know what to do. And that could happen, you know, the next few years as we go through another solar maximum. The odds are that it would happen about once every 100 years. And we came precariously close to that happening back in, I think it was April of 2017, where we missed a coronal mass ejection by 1 month. That the Earth had been just 1 month previous to where it had been, we would have been impacted by one of the largest solar storms in the last 100 years, and that would have woken us up in 2017, but we might be woken up instead in the mid 2020s.
That's a disquieting possibility, and actually it's I would say, and I'm sure you would probably agree, that we've got a pretty good look at a lot of near Earth objects and looked at their trajectories and seeing what's going to come near us, what's going to have uncomfortably close passes by us, that is something that we're getting a better handle on with each passing day, whereas coronal mass ejections are kind of just going to happen unannounced.
Right. It's like we're living near a roulette wheel, and we know that, you know, the person who comes and places the ball and lets it spin around in the wheel, it only happen, you know, they only do that so often. But we know that when they start doing it, eventually it's going to land on 00, or eventually it's going to hit black or red, and we might be able to see auroras. But every so often, something bad is going to happen, and so far our number just hasn't come up. So we have been extremely lucky, you could say, that this sort of thing hasn't happened in our technological history. Save, you know, if you were to go back to the 1850s and talk about the Carrington events, and I'm sure there's more to unpack there, but it's not a matter of if, but when it comes to these events. And the thing about asteroids is that with enough investment in money, we can begin to predict what to do in those situations. As where the satellites that are up in space now, the investment's already been made. We can try to, we'd have to put, you know, another $1 trillion of equipment back up into space if we wanted to create solar storm proof satellites, something that would actually be able to weather such a storm. And even then, we're not even sure if they would be able to weather it, because we haven't experienced something on that magnitude. So we would still be guessing. So if we only lost, say, all of the satellites that have been made up to this point, and only half the satellites that we put up there, if we tried to renovate them, we would still be losing. We'd still be losing an enormous amount in the history of humanity just on that one event. It would pretty much be plunged into a short dark age until we found a way to launch more satellites back into space and pray it doesn't happen again.
For our listeners who might not be aware, the Carrington event, if I'm not mistaken, that took place in the 1800s, was a massive solar superstorm that actually ended up shocking telegraph operators in the United States. Is that right?
That's somewhat true. So that did happen to some people, and other telegraph operators found that the extra surge of charged particles made their telegraphs work even better. So there's a communication between, I think it was like Boston and Denver, I don't remember exactly where, that where the telegraph operators were reporting that they could hear each other better than they ever could have before because of the extra flow of particles, that they went, wow, this is strange. I can hear you better than ever over the telegraph. As were, of course, there are the reports of telegraph operators saying, well, this so strong of a signal, I'm getting shocked from this thing.
So one final thing I wanted to ask you about. We've, once again, I said that we've got a pretty good idea of where a lot of these near-Earth objects are, and those are mostly asteroids. Comets, particularly long-period comets, it seems like they come out of nowhere. That is to say, we can't really see and observe the Oort cloud, these, you know, chunks of ice and the outer boundaries of the solar system. Do you think that the threat from comets is actually sort of a greater threat to humanity than asteroids, given that we can actually see asteroids and track asteroids, whereas a comet could be flying from the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt towards Earth right now, and we might not know about it until it got in our sort of neighborhood in the solar system?
Right. Well, the number of asteroids and comets that we've detected was something like, you know, 10,000 in 1990. And now we have a catalog of something like 800,000. So in a period of just 30 years, we have dramatically increased how many of these objects we know about. And so our ability to detect them has increased so much, especially as technology becomes so much more precise and we become a little bit more bold about sending robotic spacecraft to just start meticulously mapping the sky for us. So I'm not so worried about long-period comets, because the odds are that we have a long enough time to try to spot them. That even if they're coming from very, very far away, by the time they get closer and closer and closer, we'll almost certainly have spotted them. Now, what can be a little bit worrying is that we don't look as much in the when we look out of the solar system upward or downward. We're usually almost always looking in the plane of the solar system. Things that would come from, say, the asteroid belt or the Kuiper belt as they come into the sun, but we almost never look up or down. So if the Oort cloud really is like a cloud-shaped feature, then the comets could come from any direction, and we spend very little time looking in those directions.
Some pedantic people would point out that there's technically no up or down in outer space, but I would say that from a point of view of an astronomer, the ecliptic, you know, this plane that all of the planets orbit within, with the exception of Pluto, of course, this plane of the ecliptic is kind of like the, more or less like the equator in outer space, if I may use such an analogy.
Right. I actually challenge your listeners, when they imagine the solar system in their minds, do they actually see it tilted on its side as if there's no up and down? It's almost always been sold to them as being this very flat dinner plate-like object. And then they could say, well, I can imagine what up and down means, and I just mean orthogonal to the ecliptic plane, just a 90-degree angle off of the ecliptic. Yeah, I mean, the sun itself rotates in that same plane. So things coming from above or below is, I guess, what I'm talking about relative to the sun's rotation, you could even say. Now, those objects are so far away that there's a little tidbit I wanted to throw in here, is that since you mentioned Oort, Jan Oort, in your episode about this stuff, that Jan Oort was actually looking at these as trying to be an accountant for dark matter in the early stages of it, that he was thinking that perhaps the mysterious way that stars move around in the galaxy, the fact that they seem to move as if there's a mysterious extra component, that there's more to the galaxy than just stars and planets, that there might actually be more mass there than we can see with our telescopes. Oort was trying to find that material, and later on Fritz Zwicky and Vera Rubin, and he was thinking that maybe this very far-flung, dark, icy, or rocky material in the solar system could account for this extra material, this extra component to the galaxy that we hadn't measured yet.
I had no idea that he contributed to, I guess, the preliminary work, you could say, on dark matter.
Yeah, there wasn't really any evidence of dark matter yet, really what was its nature. But he certainly did it no favors in the sense that he was kind of a detractor of Vera Rubin, in that she was actually making observations of dark matter. She was actually making, measurements of distant galaxies and trying to actually figure out what is dark matter, and slowly trying to whittle away down the list and try to say, well, it's probably not just comets and asteroids. And maybe that was the thing that ticked him off to get him to go out of his way to say, she doesn't know what she's talking about.
Fascinating. Well, I know I've probably said fascinating a couple of times in this episode, but I assure you it's genuine, because you're certainly one of our best guests, and we've wanted to have you on the program for quite some time.
Well, I can assure you I'm the best guest. Well, there's a little bit more if you have the time of some things I think might fit well on your podcast.
Yes, absolutely. I was just going to see if you had any other thoughts or anything you wanted to add on this subject or any other subject for that matter.
So I think the most important thing is I don't think I heard what the difference between an asteroid, a meteor, and a meteorite is in the podcast. So I thought I might clarify that here.
Okay. Yeah, I would say that I tried to address it, but we're addressing a lot of subjects in that episode, and perhaps it wasn't abundantly clear. So please do.
All right. Maybe I just skipped over it or missed it. I mean, so I guess it's nice to say that when I talk about things in space, I almost always try to use the word meteoroid because that's vague enough that it can refer to it still being in outer space or even being on the ground. It's kind of like a combination of being a meteor and an asteroid and a meteorite all in one.
Meteoroid should not be confused with meteorite.
Right. Yeah. So if we were to just say, what's the progression of an asteroid, right? Progressions are an asteroid is just a rock in outer space. Maybe it's icy. And it floats around and then it begins, say, to get pulled into a planet. And on its descent, we start to call that a meteor. Like the meteor is the phenomenon of seeing it glow brightly in the atmosphere. And perhaps some would say that the meteor is while it's even on its trajectory to falling in. So if it's going to hit something like the moon, once it's in the final death throes right before it hits the surface of the moon, you could say that it's maybe in a meteor-like state. And then once it actually hits the ground, or if there's anything left over after the fact, that is called a meteorite. So the thing that you can actually physically hold and touch and you pick it up after the fact, that's the meteorite. So from space to ground, it goes asteroid or comet into meteor into meteorite.
And on a side note, fireballs are a particular kind of meteor that glows with an intensity greater than the planet Venus. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if it's in particular relevant to Venus, but I do know that fireballs refer to anything that glows really brightly in the sky. I thought maybe it was just a colloquial term. You might know more about that than me.
Well, it's also in the episode I realized we used the term shooting stars because I thought that would kind of jog people's memory and would be something that laymen could relate to. And I realized sort of in retrospect that shooting stars is probably not an astronomical term and probably not a term that you and your colleagues would use to describe these cosmic objects entering the Earth's atmosphere.
Who's to say? I like shooting star just as much as the next person. To me, it's that if you look up at the sky long enough, you'll eventually see one. And that's just like something like the size of a pea impacting into the atmosphere, getting heated up from all the friction against the air, and it makes it glow so brightly and it disintegrates. So a shooting star will never really reach the ground, and you really can't go up in outer space to try to find one. Maybe they impact against the International Space Station in very, very rare events, but those things are kind of the phenomenon itself is just what you see from the ground because it's so difficult. Nobody's on a trip to try to go find some.
I see. Was there anything else?
There was one more thing. I thought it might be interesting to talk about the source of Earth's water.
Right. So you actually did some work regarding comets being the source of Earth's water in your academic career. Is that right?
Yeah. So for pretty much the last few decades, astronomers have more or less had this consensus that, well, water on Earth seems like it's an anomaly, right? There's almost none on Mercury, and now we've discovered some of the icy craters on its poles. There's pretty much none on Venus. Venus is very, very dry and brittle. All the rocks on Venus's surface are almost completely water-free because it's been irradiated by the sun so much. And you look at Mars and you say, well, Mars has no magnetic field. Its water seems to have all frozen underneath the surface or escaped into space. Why does the Earth have so much water? And where did it all come from? Well, you can say, well, Earth is the largest rocky planet. It has a huge magnetic field that protects it from the sun's harmful rays. We can say that the Earth probably had a formation very similar to the other rocky planets in that it didn't form with the water on its surface. the late heavy bombardment or some sort of bombardment period probably brought icy comets and asteroids to the Earth to deposit the water. And that seems like a very strange idea because there is a lot of water on Earth, if you haven't noticed. There is a lot of water. There's like a whole ocean out there. In fact, there's like five or six oceans, depending on how you count. And for all of that water, we say that, well, if you were to take an asteroid, like the size of Mount Everest, and you were to make 10% of it made of water, how many of those would it take to hit the Earth until you had deposited enough water to make the oceans? And depending on how you variate the sizes, astronomers say it's maybe something like 100,000 asteroids, maybe something like 10 million asteroids. And if there were something like a trillion of these things floating around in the early solar system, you can imagine that a lot of them could hit the Earth and could deposit the water. And yay, now you have water on Earth, right?
Right.
Right, but there's a strange problem that comes up, which is if you were to go to the asteroids and comets that we see in the solar system today and say, oh, these are the ones that just, they got lucky. They didn't impact anything. They're still these rogue agents in the solar system. How do you find the water in them? And you go up to them and find out, well, actually, the water in them doesn't match the same water that we see on Earth.
We're talking about different types of water.
Yeah, that's very strange. I don't mean like the difference between like Aquafina and Dasani. But what I do mean is like, since we know water is H2O, H2 means two hydrogen atoms and O is an oxygen atom. And so when you actually take hydrogen just as a single proton and combine it with oxygen as its single atom there, when you combine them, you can get H2O, but you can actually throw in different numbers of neutrons into the mix. And so now we're getting into sort of atomic physics here, but if you were to say, I'm going to take a single proton of hydrogen, the simplest element in the universe, and I'm going to have it now have an extra neutron attached, then it still is hydrogen because it still is one proton, but now it's just a proton augmented with a neutron. And this neutron weighs almost the exact same amount as the proton does, has almost the exact same mass. It's just a little bit less, but this, maybe it's a little bit more. I forget, but nonetheless, you pretty much now have something that weighs twice as much as the original proton. So now you take this hydrogen proton and another hydrogen proton, both which have extra neutrons attached, you attach it to the oxygen, and you say, well, it's still water, it's still H2O. But now this water is made up of heavy hydrogens. And it weighs a little bit more than normal water does. And so when you make this measurement, you can say that this is, we call this a deuterium. The hydrogen that has an extra neutron is called deuterium. And so when you make the water, it's called deuterized water. And that's how you can create something like heavy water, because it just weighs something like 10% more than normal water does.
So getting back to these comets that supposedly crashed into the Earth during the late heavy bombardment period, what you're saying is these comets, the water in these comets is different from the water on Earth.
Right. So when astronomers go and look at the amount of the proportions, the ratios of this water, they would say, well, the solar system probably formed in such a way that you should have a certain ratio of heavy water to normal water, depending on where you look, that you'd say maybe the heavy water went more toward the center of the solar system and the lighter water could stay further out, kind of like panning for gold. The heavier things would sink to the bottom or toward the center where the sun is. And we would say that maybe we should see a certain ratio of normal water to heavy water on Earth that should match certain asteroids and comets in space. And it turns out that when we look at comets, these very icy bodies, we have a very, very small sample. It's smaller than a dozen. And I think for comets, it actually might only be like half a dozen or three or something. That the ratios of heavy water to normal water in a comet doesn't match the ocean at all. And this has been a huge revelation in the last 10 years because astronomers are now saying, well, comets are the iciest things around. And if they have the wrong ratio of this water in them compared to the Earth's oceans, then where did our water come from? And other astronomers have said, well, look at the asteroids. We've made measurements of something like a dozen asteroids now, and they seem to have more of the correct ratio than comets do. And this is surprising because asteroids don't have very much water in them. How is it that these asteroids with so little water in them by, you know, compared to something like comet, right? Comets are dominated by ice, we thought. How is it these asteroids have the ratio? How many asteroids now would it take to actually make Earth's oceans? And so this has thrown the origins of Earth's water for quite a loop in the astronomy community, because we're not quite sure what to think anymore.
It's still something of a mystery.
Yeah, it's thankfully we've narrowed it down, right? In the past, we used to think that maybe there was just a large object that impacted the Earth and deposited all the water all at once. And they call that the one big splash model, because it's just like one big water droplet just came out of space and just hit the Earth and went, aha, you're now endowed with water. But we think that it's probably actually the attrition of, hundreds of thousands, millions of different asteroids from the asteroid belt and the Kuiper belt all the way into the Earth to deposit the water.
Do you agree with the assertion that I made in the episode that the line between comets and asteroids is perhaps a little bit more blurred today than it might have been, say, 20 or 30 years ago?
Absolutely. And I like what you when you brought up Alan Stern saying that maybe a dirty snowball isn't the right term. Maybe a snowy dirt ball, right? A snowy dirt ball.
I've heard them described as deep fried ice cream as well, with the, you know, the sort of outer crust being made of, you know, being a lot rockier than we thought.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about maybe the on Pluto, we find that the ices on Pluto seem to have evaporated and refroze as it gets closer and further from the sun. Many of your listeners may not know this, but Pluto sometimes gets closer to the sun than Neptune does. And so back in the early 90s, it finally transitioned to being the furthest planet from the sun after Neptune. And so as it gets closer and further from the sun, the ices sort of, they evaporate and then they refreeze onto the planet. So you can imagine that in a halo of a comet that the ices would evaporate and create the halo and the coma around it. And then they would eventually refreeze onto the surface of the comet. And I don't know if we have any measurements or ideas of how much ice that would have to be to evaporate, but you have to think that the outer surface of a comet has almost certainly been baked and irradiated by the sun after numerous passes by the sun again and again and again, and that this large wispy cloud of ice has probably been blown away by the solar wind again and again and again, and it has to find a new way of finding new ice to make big comas, big tails, and the big glowy apparitions that we see in the sky, and that ice has to come from somewhere every time it goes around the sun. So certainly comets have to have the ice in there. Even if we don't find it too much on the surface, it's either around it or it's deep inside. Something is allowing it to make these big tails.
If you don't have anything to add, I think you thoroughly blew the minds of a lot of our listeners.
Right. Well, I will throw in that I originally got into astronomy because of comets. That in kindergarten, I saw a little book on the library shelf was called Comets. It was just one of those big, thick cardboard books that children are known to look through. And as I looked through it, I was growing up in the early 90s, and they were showing these beautiful pictures of Comet Halley that had just passed by a few years earlier. And so looking at that book, I remember that book was there the entire time I was in elementary school. And even when I went back later in middle school, I still found that same book. And so comets are the things that immediately made me say, this is magical, space is beautiful, and these comets are very weird objects. And in fact, I'm even talking on a microphone that we call a blue snowball. So it's like a comet in and of itself.
Wow. I think everybody who grows up with a fascination with space and goes on into adulthood carrying that fascination with them has a childhood story, some sort of Genesis moment where they caught the bug. And certainly I don't think it's the case with lawyers or political scientists or people in a lot of other important disciplines, that there was some moment at maybe 5, 6, 7 years old where they really got captivated by the grandeur of the cosmos or some aspect of that.
Right. And I actually was just thinking about my little cousin who transitioned from a fascination with astronomy into a fascination with dinosaurs. And to think that how whimsical fate is that the two are connected through comets and asteroids, through an enormous impact, connects everybody's two favorite topics. in terms of the mystery and grandeur of the universe. Dinosaurs and space are connected through asteroids and comets.
That is quite amazing. And I was with a group of elementary school students just the other day, and I started a astronomy presentation out with a picture of a dinosaur. And right off the bat, one or two of them said, "What do dinosaurs have to do with astronomy?" I said, that's a very good question, and I'm about to answer it.
So, and then you launch into this podcast, right? You can see you're interested in doing this podcast.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
It also, this podcast answers the question of, well, why should anybody care about astronomy? Well, because it can kill you.
Well, I hope that's far enough down on people's lists. Maybe the politicians, that's the only thing that they care about, is either, you know, for greed or, you know, their life. But I think us normal folks think that astronomy is worth exploring on its own merits. It's just so interesting and beautiful.
I would certainly agree with you 100%.
Yeah, and from a historical perspective, like you bring on this podcast, it makes it all that much more interesting that, you know, space will be there for all time, but the fate of any given other event is small, is insignificant in comparison.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Well, once again, thank you so much for coming on the program and sharing your knowledge with us, and we hope to have you back again someday.
Thank you for having me on your podcast, Grant.